2.1. The path of social reform, like the path to heaven, at any rate in India, is strewn with many difficulties. Social reform in India has few friends and many critics. The critics fall into two distinct classes. One class consists of political reformers and the other of the socialists. 2.2. It was at one time recognized that without social efficiency, no permanent progress in the other fields of activity was possible. That owing to mischief wrought by evil customs, Hindu society was not in a state of efficiency, and that ceaseless efforts must be made to eradicate these evils. It was due to the recognition of this fact that the birth of the National Congress was accompanied by the foundation of the Social Conference. While the Congress was concerned with defining the weak points in the political organization of the country, the Social Conference was engaged in removing the weak points in the social organization of Hindu society. For some time, the Congress and the Conference worked as two wings of one common activity, and they held their annual sessions in the same pandal. 2.3. But soon the two wings developed into two parties, a political reform party and a social reform party, between whom there raged a fierce controversy. The political reform party supported the National Congress, and the social reform party supported the Social Conference. The two bodies thus became two hostile camps. The point at issue was whether social reform should precede political reform. For a decade, the forces were evenly balanced, and the battle was fought without victory to either side. 2.4. It was, however, evident that the fortunes of the Social Conference were ebbing fast. The gentleman who presided over the sessions of the Social Conference lamented that the majority of the educated Hindus were for political advancement and indifferent to social reform, and that while the number of those who attended the Congress was very large, and the number who did not attend but who sympathized with it was even larger, the number of those who attended the Social Conference was very much smaller. 2.5. This indifference, this thinning of its ranks, was soon followed by active hostility from the politicians. Under the leadership of the late Mr. Tilak, the courtesy with which the Congress allowed the Social Conference the use of its pandal was withdrawn, and the spirit of enmity went to such a pitch that when the Social Conference desired to erect its own pandal, a threat to burn the pandal was held out by its opponents. Thus, in the course of time, the party in favor of political reform won, and the Social Conference vanished and was forgotten. 2.6. The speech delivered by Mr. W.C. Banerjee in 1892 at Allahabad as president of the 8th session of the Congress sounds like a funeral oration on the death of the Social Conference, and is so typical of the Congress attitude that I venture to quote from it the following extract. Mr. Banerjee said, "I for one have no patience with those who say, we shall not be fit for political reform until we reform our social system. I fail to see any connection between the two. Are we not fit for political reform because our widows remain unmarried and our girls are given in marriage earlier than in other countries? Because our wives and daughters do not drive about with us visiting our friends? Because we do not send our daughters to Oxford and Cambridge?" 2.7. I have stated the case for political reform as put by Mr. Banerjee. There were many who were happy that the victory went to the Congress, but those who believe in the importance of social reform may ask, is an argument such as that of Mr. Banerjee final? Does it prove that the victory went to those who were in the right? Does it prove conclusively that social reform has no bearing on political reform? It will help us to understand the matter if I state the other side of the case. I will draw upon the treatment of the untouchables for my facts. 2.8. Under the rule of the Peshwas in the Maratha country, the untouchable was not allowed to use the public streets if a Hindu was coming along, lest he should pollute the Hindu by his shadow. The untouchable was required to have a black thread either on his wrist or around his neck as a sign or a mark to prevent the Hindus from getting themselves polluted by his touch by mistake. In Pune, the capital of the Peshwa, the untouchable was required to carry, strung from his waist, a broom to sweep away from behind himself the dust he trod on, lest a Hindu walking on the same dust should be polluted. In Pune, the untouchable was required to carry an earthen pot hung around his neck wherever he went for holding his spit, lest his spit, falling on the earth, should pollute a Hindu who might unknowingly happen to tread on it. 2.9. Let me take more recent facts. The tyranny practiced by the Hindus upon the Balais, an untouchable community in central India, will serve my purpose. You will find a report of this in the Times of India of 4th January 1928. The correspondent of the Times of India reported that high-caste Hindus, viz. Kalotas, Rajputs and Brahmins, including the Patels and Patwaris of the villages of Kanaria, Bicholi Hapsi, Bicholi Mardana, and about 15 other villages in Indore district of Indore state, informed the Balais of their respective villages that if they wish to live among them, they must conform to the following rules. 1. Balais must not wear gold lace-bordered pagdis. 2. They must not wear dhotis with coloured or fancy borders. 3. They must convey intimation of the death of any Hindu to relatives of the deceased, no matter how far away these relatives may be living. 4. In all Hindu marriages, Balais must play music before the processions and during the marriage. 5. Balai women must not wear gold or silver ornaments. They must not wear fancy gowns or jackets. 6. Balai women must attend all cases of confinement of Hindu women. 7. Balais must render services without demanding remuneration and must accept whatever a Hindu is pleased to give. 8. If the Balais do not agree to abide by these terms, they must clear out of the villages. 2.10. The Balais refused to comply, and the Hindu element proceeded against them. Balais were not allowed to get water from the village wells. They were not allowed to let their cattle graze. Balais were prohibited from passing through land owned by a Hindu, so that if the field of a Balai was surrounded by fields owned by Hindus, the Balai could have no access to his own field. The Hindus also let their cattle graze down the fields of the Balais. The Balais submitted petitions to the Darbar against these persecutions, but as they could get no timely relief, and the oppression continued, hundreds of Balais with their wives and children were obliged to abandon their homes, in which their ancestors had lived for generations, and to migrate to adjoining states, that is, to villages in Dhar, Devas, Bagli, Bhopal, Gwalior, and other states. What happened to them in their new homes may for the present be left out of our consideration. 2.11. The incident at Kavitha in Gujarat happened only last year. The Hindus of Kavitha ordered the untouchables not to insist upon sending their children to the common village school maintained by the government. What sufferings the untouchables of Kavitha had to undergo for daring to exercise a civic right against the wishes of the Hindus is too well known to need detailed description. Another instance occurred in the village of Zanu in the Ahmedabad district of Gujarat. In November 1935, some untouchable women of well-to-do families started fetching water in metal pots. The Hindus looked upon the use of metal pots by untouchables as an affront to their dignity and assaulted the untouchable women for their impudence. 2.12. A most recent event is reported from the village of Chakwara in Jaipur state. It seems from the reports that have appeared in the newspapers that an untouchable of Chakwara, who had returned from a pilgrimage, had arranged to give a dinner to his fellow untouchables of the village as an act of religious piety. The host desired to treat the guests to a sumptuous meal, and the items served included ghee or butter also. But while the assembly of untouchables was engaged in partaking of the food, the Hindus, in their hundreds, armed with lathis, rushed to the scene, despoiled the food, and belabored the untouchables who left the food and ran for their lives. And why was this murderous assault committed on defenseless untouchables? The reason given is that the untouchable host was impudent enough to serve ghee, and his untouchable guests were foolish enough to taste it. Ghee is undoubtedly a luxury for the rich. But no one would think that consumption of ghee was a mark of high social status. The Hindus of Chakwara thought otherwise, and in righteous indignation avenged themselves for the wrong done to them by the untouchables, who insulted them by treating ghee as an item of their food, which they ought to have known could not be theirs, consistently with the dignity of the Hindus. This means that an untouchable must not use ghee, even if he can afford to buy it, since it is an act of arrogance towards the Hindus. This happened on or about the 1st of April 1936. 2.13. Having stated the facts, let me now state the case for social reform. In doing this, I will follow Mr. Banerjee as nearly as I can and ask the political-minded Hindus, are you fit for political power, even though you do not allow a large class of your own countrymen, like the untouchables, to use public schools? Are you fit for political power, even though you do not allow them the use of public wells? Are you fit for political power, even though you do not allow them the use of public streets? Are you fit for political power, even though you do not allow them to wear what apparel or ornaments they like? Are you fit for political power, even though you do not allow them to eat any food they like? I can ask a string of such questions, but these will suffice. 2.14. I wonder what would have been the reply of Mr. Banerjee. I am sure no sensible man will have the courage to give an affirmative answer. Every congressman who repeats the dogma of John Stuart Mill that one country is not fit to rule another country must admit that one class is not fit to rule another class. How is it then that the Social Reform Party lost the battle? To understand this correctly, it is necessary to take note of the kind of social reform which the reformers were agitating for. In this connection, it is necessary to make a distinction between social reform in the sense of the reform of the Hindu family and social reform in the sense of the reorganization and reconstruction of Hindu society. The former has a relation to widow remarriage, child remarriage, etc., while the latter relates to the abolition of the caste system. 2.15. The Social Conference was a body which mainly concerned itself with the reform of the high caste Hindu family. It consisted mostly of enlightened high caste Hindus who did not feel the necessity for agitating for the abolition of caste, or had not the courage to agitate for it. They felt, quite naturally, a greater urge to remove such evils as enforced widowhood, child marriages, etc., evils which prevailed among them and which were personally felt by them. They did not stand up for the reform of Hindu society. The battle that was fought centered round the question of the reform of the family. It did not relate to social reform in the sense of the breakup of the caste system. It was never put in issue by the reformers, That is the reason why the Social Reform Party lost. 2.16. I am aware that this argument cannot alter the fact that political reform did in fact gain precedence over social reform. But the argument has this much value, if not more. It explains why social reformers lost the battle. It also helps us to understand how limited was the victory which the political reform party obtained over the social reform party, and to understand that the view that social reform need not precede political reform is a view which may stand only when by social reform is meant the reform of the family. That political reform cannot with impunity take precedence over social reform in the sense of the reconstruction of society is a thesis which I am sure cannot be controverted. 2.17. That the makers of political constitutions must take account of social forces is a fact which is recognized by no less a person than Ferdinand Lassalle, the friend and co-worker of Karl Marx. In addressing a Prussian audience in 1862, Lassalle said, "The constitutional questions are in the first instance not questions of right, but questions of might. The actual constitution of a country has its existence only in the actual condition of force which exists in the country. Hence, political constitutions have value and permanence only when they accurately express those conditions of forces which exist in practice within a society." 2.18. But it is not necessary to go to Prussia. There is evidence at home. What is the significance of the communal award, with its allocation of political power in defined proportions to diverse classes and communities? In my view, its significance lies in this, that political constitution must take note of social organization. It shows that the politicians who denied that the social problem in India had any bearing on the political problem were forced to reckon with the social problem in devising the constitution. The communal award is, so to say, the nemesis following upon the indifference to and neglect of social reform. It is a victory for the Social Reform Party, which shows that, though defeated, they were in the right in insisting upon the importance of social reform. Many, I know, will not accept this finding. The view is current, and it is pleasant to believe in it, that the communal award is unnatural and that it is the result of an unholy alliance between the minorities and the bureaucracy. I do not wish to rely on the communal award as a piece of evidence to support my contention, if it is said that it is not good evidence. 2.19. Let us turn to Ireland. What does the history of Irish Home Rule show? It is well known that in the course of the negotiations between the representatives of Ulster and Southern Ireland, Mr. Redmond, the representative of Southern Ireland, in order to bring Ulster into a home ruled constitution common to the whole of Ireland, said to the representatives of Ulster, "Ask any political safeguards you like, and you shall have them." What was the reply that Ulstermen gave? Their reply was, "Damn your safeguards, we don't want to be ruled by you on any terms." People who blame the minorities in India ought to consider what would have happened to the political aspirations of the majority if the minorities had taken the attitude which Ulster took. Judged by the attitude of Ulster to Irish Home Rule, is it nothing that the minorities agreed to be ruled by the majority, which has not shown much sense of statesmanship, provided some safeguards were devised for them? But this is only incidental. The main question is, why did Ulster take this attitude? The only answer I can give is that there was a social problem between Ulster and Southern Ireland. The problem between Catholics and Protestants, which is essentially a problem of caste. That home rule in Ireland would be Rome rule was the way in which the Ulstermen had framed their answer. But that is only another way of stating that it was the social problem of caste between the Catholics and the Protestants which prevented the solution of the political problem. This evidence again is sure to be challenged. It will be urged that here too the hand of the imperialist was at work. 2.20. But my resources are not exhausted. I will give evidence from the history of Rome. Here, no one can say that any evil genius was at work. Anyone who has studied the history of Rome will know that the Republican Constitution of Rome bore marks having strong resemblance to the communal award. When the kingship in Rome was abolished, the kingly power or the imperium was divided between the consuls and the Pontifex Maximus. In the consuls was vested the secular authority of the king, while the latter took over the religious authority of the king. This republican constitution had provided that of the two consuls, one was to be patrician and the other plebeian. The same constitution had also provided that of the priests under the Pontifex Maximus, half were to be plebeians and the other half patricians. Why is it that the Republican Constitution of Rome had these provisions which, as I said, resemble so strongly the provisions of the communal award? The only answer one can get is that the Constitution of Republican Rome had to take account of the social division between the patricians and the plebeians, who formed two distinct castes. To sum up, let political reformers turn in any direction they like. They will find that in the making of a constitution, they cannot ignore the problem arising out of the prevailing social order. 2.21. The illustrations which I have taken in support of the proposition that social and religious problems have a bearing on political constitutions seem to be too particular. Perhaps they are. But it should not be supposed that the bearing of the one on the other is limited. On the other hand, one can say that, generally speaking, history bears out the proposition that political revolutions have always been preceded by social and religious revolutions. The religious reformation started by Luther was the precursor of the political emancipation of the European people. In England, Puritanism led to the establishment of political liberty. Puritanism founded the New World. It was Puritanism which won the War of American Independence, and Puritanism was a religious movement. 2.22. The same is true of the Muslim Empire. Before the Arabs became a political power, they had undergone a thorough religious revolution started by the Prophet Muhammad. Even Indian history supports the same conclusion. The political revolution led by Chandragupta was preceded by the religious and social revolution of Buddha. The political revolution led by Shivaji was preceded by the religious and social reform brought about by the saints of Maharashtra. The political revolution of the Sikhs was preceded by the religious and social revolution led by Guru Nanak. It is unnecessary to add more illustrations. These will suffice to show that the emancipation of the mind and the soul is a necessary preliminary for the political expansion of the people.